From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on February 28th in Columbia, South Carolina. A man wearing all black entered the Columbiana Center Mall and began asking shoppers unsettling questions. 2 days later, police questioned the man, who was found to be carrying some drugs at the time. He was banned from the mall for a year. 11 days later, a police officer recognized the man, who was now sitting in a parked car near a park in downtown Columbia. The officer searched the man's car and found a forearm grip for an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle and 6 unloaded magazines, all capable of holding 40 rounds. The man admitted to the police officer that he wanted to purchase an AR-15, but didn't have enough money. It's not against the law in South Carolina to possess a firearm grip, so police let the man go. He was not charged. On April 26th, that same man was found back on the mall property. He was charged with trespassing. His ban was extended to 3 years. The man in question was Dylan Roof. On June 17th, he attended a Bible study group at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. You probably know that he opened fire with a handgun, killing 9 people. By all accounts, Dylan Roof was what we might call a lone wolf. He was apparently not part of a terror group or cell, not taking orders from others. Almost certainly that makes it harder to stop him, harder to track him. But were there missed opportunities here? How do law enforcement agencies handle lone wolf investigations? My guests for this hour have extensive experience in this from a couple different sides of the legal spectrum, and they're going to talk about this and some other subjects. Mark Concordia is here. Mark is director of the Criminal Justice Administration Program at Roberts Wesleyan College. He spent 13 years with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. Nice to have you back here, Mark.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Evan.
Also here is William Hochul, United States Attorney for the Western District of New York. And Bill, nice to have you in studio.
Thank you, Evan.
Mark, you and I communicated a little bit right when the shootings happened in Charleston, South Carolina. And, nobody would dispute that Dylan Roof has a lot of problems, that when he announced he was there to kill black people, he apparently told police he almost didn't go through with it, because the people were so nice to him, but he did it anyway. You go back to some of those things that happened earlier, and people are already saying, well, they missed chances. They could have arrested this guy. They could have done this or that. And I'm not sure if they would have had the authority to do that. Is it worth going back step by step, and is it harder in a lone wolf to actually stop someone?
Yeah, the answer to that question is yes and yes. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely worth going back and providing conducting an analysis. We call it in the field, we call it an ideographic study of what happened. Because these events are so random and so frequent, it appears that they're not, because of the phenomenon and at least the speed in which they're occurring. They really are a micro event. So it is really worth going back and doing an ideographic, which is an absolute complete case study of what happened, what about the individual brought them to this pathway to violence. Were there opportunities? What behavioral indicators were there that we can learn from and instruct future paradigms? Now, yes, the lone wolf scenario or the homegrown violent extremist scenario is one of the hardest that I had to investigate during my 13 years. Following 9/11, we were what I would call, there was two types of investigations that I was involved in. One would be this, we can categorize as the traditional terrorist investigation, where there was information or allegation that an individual was tied to a foreign terrorist organization. He was communicating with Al-Qaeda or LET or one of these other groups, or a member of. And you can really conduct an investigation to try to determine that. Is there, and it's very deductive, right? Deductive reasoning. Is there facts and circumstances to corroborate the information or allegation that was received? And at the end of the day, you can come to a fairly confident conclusion of whether or not this person has these allegations were true. Now, as my career went on, probably the last half of my career is when we really started to see the manifestation of the threat, the evolution of the threat come to this inspired or lone wolf or homegrown violent extremist, and with no connections to a foreign terrorist group. So you'd get information or allegation that you had to investigate, but there wasn't those telltale signs, the communication with a foreign terrorist organization that could really help provide the facts and evidence that you need. So now you had to combine what we call deductive and inductive reasoning. You had to take some inference that this individual is doing A, B, and C, that may be leading him on this pathway to violence. So those investigations really became more of what we call threat case management. And it's a very different type of investigation and a very difficult type of investigation.
We're going to talk this hour about what law enforcement does from many different angles, trying to prevent these kinds of violent incidents, and also what the public can do, because there are a lot of different factors involved. The goal of this program is not to scare anybody or to drum up some sort of panic that that on every street corner is a lone wolf in this country. But at the same time, I do want to ask Mark and Bill this question. I remember speaking to Michael Kirk, who is the executive producer, the producer of Frontline for PBS for a number of shows, and he has interviewed the Obama administration, the Obamas, the family, the people involved many times. And last year he was here in Rochester and he said he remembers talking to the president and hearing the story that 24 hours before Barack Obama's inauguration in January 2009, he was told that there was reasonably credible concern of an attack on the inauguration. And then he was at least told, maybe you don't want your family there. Maybe we should cancel the whole thing. One of his advisors said, nothing public, nothing outdoors. Do it at noon. Do it in 5 minutes. Do it in the Oval Office and you're done. And get on with your day. Cancel everything. Not worth it. And Barack Obama had to make a decision. Do I, you know, he had to weigh everything. Will I look weak if I do this? And how credible is the concern? And what can we do? And how well protected are we? Now, of course, we know they had tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people attend it, and it carried off generally without a hitch. But Michael Kirk said that was the moment when he got into the White House and said, I mean, you just can't know until you see the day-to-day, the conversations, the things the public doesn't know. Now, Mark Concordi, part of your work was dealing with those kind of things. You know, don't scare us, but tell us, how often are these things happening out there that we don't know about, that would keep you up at night?
Well, any allegation or information of a potential threat of violence keeps me up at night, and it kept me up at night because I had a tremendous responsibility, and the responsibility was not to be reactive, right? Because if you're being reactive, it's too late. It was a preventative methodology. So, I mean, when I worked for the counterterrorism task force, I mean, we were fairly busy, and a lot of it was information or allegations. And we had to do an absolute complete and comprehensive investigation, and we did so. And we were just one component of the counterterrorism mechanism that was out there, you know, and along with our partners in DOJ. And we don't want to scare people, but it's a real threat. I mean, what's happening around the world, unfortunately, with the information that is instantly accessible in people's homes these days, the potential for this narrative to be beamed in virtually online in everybody's computer, and individuals who have a grievance, or individuals who are somewhat disaffected or have these other idiosyncratic personality or psychological issues, if they are exposed to a narrative that justifies violence, then we have a dangerous recipe along that pathway to violence. So once again, don't want everybody to be scared. But it's a real threat that we all have to be concerned with.
And Bill Hochul, then, I'm curious, you know, your office, you were the lead prosecutor in the Lackawanna Six. We of course, know the story from last, I think, September, the arrest of Mufid Elfki in Rochester. And you want to get there before the violence happens. You want to be successful and stop that. But at the same time, there has to be decisions on when an arrest is made, when an investigation is happening, so as not to obstruct civil liberties. You know, we have a delicate balance. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely, Evan. And I can say that having now been a federal prosecutor for 28 years, when we're talking about counterterrorism, whether it be the international type sites such as ISIS, ISIL, Al-Qaeda, or any one of the other foreign terrorist organizations, or domestic terrorist groups, domestic lone wolf attacks, nothing is more challenging to us as prosecutors and federal law enforcement officers. As Mark said, when you have a given crime that happens under our territory here in Rochester, Monroe County, we do a very, very good job of finding out who pulled the trigger, who committed the traffic incident, and we make an arrest and proceed from there. When you're talking about the possible terrorist attack, the consequences can be so devastating that we in law enforcement turn over heaven and earth to try to find a way to charge a person if the law allows us to do it. Now, here's where the challenge comes in. So much of what terrorists in particular are engaging in, whether it be the practice of religion with certain tenets, whether it be the articulation through speech of certain desires they may have, I would like to kill, fill in the blank, that is covered by the First Amendment to our Constitution. As a matter of fact, if we go back to Civil War era, post-Civil War, Nathan Bedford Forrest created this group of men who would run around with sheets over their head. There's freedom of assembly in this country. There's freedom to protest and redress grievances through different sorts of public demonstrations. There would not be the ability, in the case of the Ku Klux Klan, to arrest people simply because they were wearing robes, even if they were chanting certain despicable things. We have to account for that, and we only make arrests and then proceed under the arrest criminal justice path where a crime has been committed. It has to already be in the books. Otherwise, we have what we call an ex post facto problem. So Congress, in our case, had to already have defined the certain conduct as criminal. And then we have to be able to show to a jury and a judge that our evidence does not equate to simple First Amendment exercise of constitutionally protected practices. So it's phenomenally challenging. And to also get back to your comment about what the president confronted, I can tell the public that since I've been doing this, and it's almost 14 years now, just this counterterrorism topic, it is something that causes everybody in the field to lay awake at night because we are getting constant information, not just from our community partners, from residents who have concerns. They dial 911 and they want to make a report, and that's all very, very valuable, and I always want to encourage the public to do it. But we're also getting reports from foreign partners. We're getting discoveries found on battlefields, and all of that information is flowing into our region all the time, and the determination has to be made, what is the true threat, what is the needle in the haystack, or what simply is more hay in the haystack? And sure, that's the challenge.
Sure. And so let's take Dylann Roof as just the most recent tragic example. And I opened the hour talking about some of what the public knows. I'm sure there is much more that law enforcement now has gathered that we don't know about. But Mark Concordia, I've got no problem saying, okay, I take Dylann Roof's word for it, that he stood up and said, I was here to kill black people. Mm-hmm. I think based on what we've seen so far, it's wise of us to at least take his word on that account. But there's that old maxim, the cause is rarely the cause. So do you have any doubt that Dylann Roof was there to kill black people, or talk to me about some of the layers that law enforcement are going to be dealing with here?
Sure. I absolutely have no doubt that he was there to kill African Americans. Yep. There was no doubt. I mean, he was a stated cause. But when we talk about the cause is sometimes rarely the cause or is not the cause, what we're really talking about is the principle of cause and effect, okay? So Dylann Roof's racist narrative, racist ideations, has definitely a positive correlation to the outcome, and which was this devastating attack. But did it have a direct cause and effect relationship? That's the principles that we in law enforcement really try to adhere to. There's so many different causal factors that go into somebody beginning the pathway to violence or actually committing a violent act, that we realize that this a lot of times is a process that goes back years and years and years. It's not only individual psychology, it could be group psychology, it could be cultural factors, the environment from which this person grew up in. So to narrow the cause, to say that the absolute direct cause of this tragedy was the narrative of racial superiority, mm-hmm, really inhibits the analysis of the event to conduct, or at least the analysis of the event, to provide us with what we need, the research and the details, to come up with real preventative strategies.
And just as an example, there are many people who are racist in this country. There are many people who hate people from all different backgrounds, and the vast majority will never carry out a mass killing, right?
Absolutely, and this goes back to that. That's really logical and substantial proof that there is a positive correlation, but it doesn't have a direct cause and effect. Otherwise, you would see this a lot more often. It's a psychological process. Radicalization to violence is a process, okay, that has a lot of layers. There's a confluence of factors. And a lot of times the relationships become obscured, and there's multiple factors that actually correlate to a cause-direct-effect relationship.
Bill Hochul, what are some of the things that your colleagues in South Carolina are dealing with now as they investigate that case?
Well, Levin, I can't talk about specifically the Dylann Roof case because obviously it is now the subject of a criminal case and defendants are entitled to a presumption of innocence, and it would be inappropriate for me to give specifics on that case. But confining myself just to what we do in general.
Yes.
We try to do an extensive examination, as Mark suggested, of how exactly Dylann Roof, or again, leaving aside Dylann Roof, the perpetrator of a crime, got on this conveyor belt. We would try to identify whether there were any other accomplices. That's first and foremost, is to neutralize any other threat that may still be out there. We would be entitled to search the perpetrator's home if we obtained a search warrant. We could look at his computer, again, using court-authorized process. We would try to reconstruct where did the weapon come from, where were the bullets acquired. And in many ways, this was similar to what we did after William Spangler several years ago engaged in his own mass casualty attack right here in Webster, West Webster. Here's a fella who killed a couple of first responders, wounded two others, and then he committed suicide. He, of course, left a note, and then through our subsequent investigation, we determined the firearm had been illegally provided for him by Dawn Nguyen. We then charged her, convicted her, and she remains in jail. So we would do a comprehensive approach that, number one, begins with neutralizing any remaining threat right that may be out there, and then finding out whether there's other perpetrators for the particular event that we should really have in custody in order to bring justice to the victims.
My guest for the hour, you're hearing there from William Hochul, U.S. Attorney for the Western District of New York, and Mark Concordia is here as well. Mark is the Director of the Criminal Justice Administration Program at Roberts Wesleyan College and spent 13 years with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. We're looking at the way law enforcement investigates and tries to prevent, for example, what we saw in Charleston. We'll try to answer some of your questions as they come in as well. And Mark, you emailed me, and I've been trying to sort of absorb a lot of what you sent. You know, frankly, I'm sure that you just gave me a small bite of the apple for what the FBI and what investigators deal with here. But they include the path to intended violence, and which is a number of steps that are sort of maybe obvious to some, but it's interesting to me to kind of go through some of these if we could, because I think there are some instructive things for those of us who want law enforcement to be successful. The path to intended violence, this general model comes from where?
It actually comes from Calhoun and Weston in their book, Contemporary Threat Management. And it tends to be an amalgam of different theories out there, but this one is very instructive for the particular threat of a lone wolf or an individual who has intent of a mass casualty.
All right, and so the steps, and I'll give you the broad steps first: grievance, then ideation, research and planning, preparation, breach, and attack. And there are telltale signs for all of these preceding the attack that, you know, you start with telltale signs of grievance, sense of injustice, sense of mission, a sense of loss or a sense of destiny, a desire for revenge, a desire for recognition or fame. Now, how does that rise above you? A sense of injustice. A lot of people feel a sense of injustice. This, though, these kind of factors seem to rise above the basic complaining people might do about work or a boss or a relationship.
Sure. And, you know, there's experts out there that have posited that the root of all violence is a sense of injustice. And I found that to be very true in terms of my academic side, my research and theory side that I combine with my practitioner side. But when we talk about grievance, as you accurately stated, we all have grievances. Everybody has a grievance. But what we see in this pathway to intended violence is when the grievance becomes all-encompassing, it becomes somewhat pathological, where the individual begins to, we'll say, either transfer or project some of their own disaffected or feelings that they have that are causing them to feel distress or anxiety. And that could be everything from humiliation to honor to marginalization to a sense of failure. So when you have a grievance, it tends to start making sense to you to project that to others. And that becomes what we call pathological. So it goes beyond.
Bill?
What I think the public also needs to understand, though, is that the people that may feel this injustice may, in fact, be very successful members of a given society. We would not want to at all leave the impression that these might be folks that are standing on a street corner in some particular urban area. If you look at the perpetrators or maybe even the leaders of terrorist networks, what we find is that they are generally very successful people. They are from the upper middle class of their society. They're multilingual. Many have advanced college degrees, frequently in the sciences, not the humanities. So you have a group of folks who have perhaps gone on this pathway of violence, but I would acknowledge have agreed to use a certain technique, a terrorist technique, beyond just simple killing, symbolic massacre killing, in order for a greater message to be received by the intended audience. So this is something that we need to keep in mind as well. This possible perpetrator is, we've been mentioning Dylan Stormroof, but it may even be somebody who is a doctor who is living abroad. It may be a scientist. It's a phenomenally challenging group that we are now trying to identify who would in fact be the final perpetrator, the person who maybe pulls the trigger.
Bill, I would absolutely agree with you. In the concept that I discussed earlier about the what we call traditional terrorism or this new and evolving threat, you know, when you talk about, I think you're talking exactly about the true believers, those who have committed themselves 100% to the cause, and they're phenomenally, you know, and research shows that these are very well-adjusted, successful individuals. When we look at this concept of the lone terrorist, and we're not just talking about, you know, concept of ideologically inspired groups like from ISIL or others. We're talking about, you know, this mass casualty. It could be workplace violence. It could be domestic violence. It could be any type of what we call intended or predatory violence. When this individual is radicalizing alone or going along this pathway, there are some consistencies. And whether it's a true believer or whether it's a person that is ideologically inspired, it really comes from the sense of grievance. Most of the terrorist narratives have a grievance component to it, a defensive component. Most importantly, they have an us versus them component, which we have to pay attention to and avoid.
I would agree with that last point. And the them, unfortunately, becomes demonized in the mind of the lone wolf or in the mind of the terrorist group. It's not enough to just have an enemy. You have to dehumanize that enemy. Think of it perhaps as the devil. Then in your own mind, it justifies the use not just of fatal violence, but of demonstrably evil violence, because now you are fighting for this greater cause.
The next step on the path to intended violence is ideation, and those include discussing with others, identifying with other assailants, a violence-only alternative, a fascination with weapons, and a fixation on anniversaries. Okay, the first one there, discussion with others. Let me bring up a question from one of our listeners. Jake writes to us, although I don't want to play the mental health card too much in Dylan Roof's case, given the red flags that were going on in his case, why is there little to no talk or push to get these individuals psychological assistance? There are obviously free speech issues at play here, but the number of individuals that are on record as saying Dylan Roof was making credible threats of violence is disturbing. Was any assistance even offered to him? I don't know the answer to that. It's a good question. Mark?
Well, I think first we have to understand that mental illness does not have a significant positive correlation to acts of violence. Okay, that's
it. Does not.
It does not. Research has suggested, and specifically when we're talking about terrorist organizations or these type of mass events like this, that mental illness is a very, very low variable.
That's interesting because so often, and we're not going to derail this. Don't worry, we're not going to derail this on the talk of what to do about firearm rights, et cetera. But often we hear people say, well, what we really have is a mental health problem. And you're saying a lot of these acts of violence are not driven by mental health problems.
Research suggests that that's true, that the mentally ill are not violent, especially in this type of discussion. What we see, unfortunately, in manifestations of sometimes violence of those who are mentally ill, it's usually the people that are closest to them that are affected. Their immediate social sphere, not these acts of public violence.
And so sometimes I think the media falls into this trap, and some of the rhetoric we hear about violence is that anyone who would carry out acts of violence is definitionally mentally ill. And you're saying no.
No, that's incorrect. You have to look at the, once again, objective analysis of the facts and these ideographic studies. The choice to begin the pathway to violence becomes a very rational choice for these individuals. And in their minds, this is rational. It's an ends means thinking, or means justify the, mm-hmm. The ends justify the means type of thinking. And those who definitionally are mentally ill are not rational, okay, in terms. So it's a very rational choice. And the research, there's Mark Sageman has done some phenomenal research on actual terrorists, and less than 1%, I think it was over 200 studies, individual case studies, less than 1% had any type of diagnosed psychosis. Now, we're not saying that there's personality issues that are involved, antisocial feelings and stuff like that, but when you talk about what we could define mental illness, it doesn't correlate to an actual cause and effect.
I would agree with that, too, because if you're speaking about people that join terrorist groups, if you had some sort of very obvious defect, a terrorist group wouldn't necessarily even want you because there would be a perception that you might bring unwanted scrutiny to them before their actual planned attack could take place. And over the years, I've had a chance to sit down with different terrorists, whether they be folks that we've arrested here in the U.S., whether it be people abroad. And I can tell you that the terrorists that I've spoken to, they get along very well with other people. They are rational. They have functioning capacities. And again, going back to the Sageman study, Understanding Terror Networks, they are very well educated. But what is different or distinguishes them from the normal person is that they do have this belief, number one, that they have all the answers or their system has all the answers. They demonize the enemy. And then they do have access to weapons, if you're going to talk about a firearm type event. But if you look at what ISIL is doing lately, they behead people. And everybody has access to a knife in your ordinary kitchen. And then they also have a videotape where they continue to promote this violence and this event over and over again. So it's not just a firearm issue, it's not a mental health issue, it's much more complex. There's a whole lot of people engaging in terrorism throughout history, frankly, that we could not classify as mentally ill.
Okay, and Mark, as listener Jake points out, at least in the Dylann Roof case, there do appear to be moments where he was verbalizing, and at least for those of us who are hoping that people like you and Bill are successful, that you are dealing with mostly prevention as opposed to the aftermath. The fact that there's verbalization, the fact that on the ideation process often includes discussion with others, that is heartening a little bit. It makes me think then we've got a chance here to stop something.
I'd like to agree with you 100%. And it does provide an opportunity, but unfortunately, for decades, we've seen very traumatic events. Specifically, we can even look to some of the massive casualty school shootings, where over half of the assailants verbalized their intent or actually tried to gain conspirators in their attempt. It's called the concept of leakage. It occurs very often, but it's so hard for individuals in that social sphere to accept the fact that this person is saying something that they so violent and so despicable that they may actually carry it through. But we're in a new age, unfortunately, of this terrorism and of this phenomenon where before, a lot of times when individuals would consider, have an ideation, maybe a suicidal ideation, now it becomes a homicidal, suicidal ideation, and they want to take this thing public. So that's where we need the communities. We need those who are around the social sphere of these individuals to pay attention to what they're saying. What is that grievance? Has it become pathological? And most importantly, has the cognitive opening occurred where an ideation of violence, the accepting of violence as a justifiable resolution to their grievance, has now manifested in some way? And that could be from a narrative from Al-Qaeda or ISIL, or it could be a racist rant, or it could be anything that suggests that violence, a revolutionary movement, a national movement, doesn't matter, that violence is acceptable. Once you combine those, we have a real issue that we have to pay attention to.
And to follow up on what Mark said, we really need the public in two respects. Number one, they need to alert us in law enforcement about their observations, because even though on television the cops are on every street corner and they look at every email, in reality, we only do these kinds of techniques with court orders, and it's a very, very constitutionally rigorous process. So number one, tell law enforcement what you may be seeing if there's a problem. But number two, you need to engage. Every person that's listening to this program now has a vested interest. They have knowledge. They have an interest in ensuring that if they are detecting some anomalies in a person, a friend, a child's behavior, they need to engage. They can't ignore it. They can use their own good offices. If it's a parent-child relationship, express to the child that this is simply unacceptable. If it's a clergy-penitent relationship, they need to engage. Doctor-patient, teacher-student, there's indications in other mass casualty episodes where perhaps somebody in college might have written an essay that a professor read, such as Professor Concordia here, that this is what I want to do on my next summer vacation. Everybody needs to know that these are dangerous signs, and you just can't ignore it.
And Mark, you mentioned that more than 50% of shooters in mass casualty situations, was it in school settings?
School shootings.
In school settings, verbalized intentions, and really almost nothing apparently stopped it. If you've got all of these people hearing it, why? Why was it that these verbal, these comments, these verbalizations were essentially ignored? Fear?
No, I don't think fear. From my research, what seems to be inhibiting a lot of this, once again, is it's a very micro event. So you take a person that's a teacher or a counselor or someone that has access to large numbers of people. They see sometimes these ideations. You know, kids make these bold statements in terms of school shootings or whatever, not in explicit school shootings, but they have these ideations of violence or maybe, and it never really manifests to anything. And so we kind of get complacent with, well, this student really isn't going to do that. And we also have to be very careful. Once again, you're trying to get into the head of somebody. Do they really mean what they're saying? And I think there's a reluctance on parents, on counselors or school administrators or anybody that has this access to make what we call a sticky diagnosis, right? You would say, well, this person is potentially violent, and I'm going to bring that to the authorities, and now that could follow this person. So those things tend to inhibit what we're doing, how we can really identify this at the grievance or ideation stage.
We are we're going to take a short break, come back with your phone calls for our guests for the hour. Mark Concordia, you're just hearing, is the director of the Criminal Justice Administration Program at Roberts Wesleyan College and spent 13 years with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. William Hochul is here, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of New York. We're talking about how law enforcement goes about handling lone wolf investigations, the kinds of which we've recently seen, unfortunately, play out tragically in the news, how to prevent that, and what we all can kind of keep in mind and learn from what law enforcement studies. So short break, your phone calls straight ahead. Coming up in our second hour, we talk about the raise the age debate. What is the age when someone should be prosecuted as an adult, not as a child? New York State prosecutes 16 and 17-year-olds as adults, one of only two states to do that, and the raise the age effort aims to change that. We're going to hear from all sides and talk about the compromise that New York State recently reached on this question. That's next hour in Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Village at Unity, independent senior living that supports an active, independent lifestyle, offering hospitality, personal transportation, and other amenities. The Village at Unity, like no other. For tours, call 723-7442.
I want to wrap at least one important part of the discussion before I get to your phone calls, and I'll do that in just a second. We've been talking about the path to intended violence, and I have no doubt, Mark, if our listeners Google it, they can find it and take a quick look themselves, which I think would be instructive. We've hit the sense of the grievance, which is the first step, and then ideation. Beyond that, you got research, planning, preparation, breach, and then attack. It seems to me that grievance and ideation are the openings that are most likely when they are verbalizing that others might notice. It seems that once we get beyond that, once we're into preparation, that it might be farther down the road and harder to stop. Yes or no?
Well, yes and no.
I'm not saying it's unstoppable.
Right. Yes, it's harder to stop because those last steps in the pathway can happen very quickly.
But just a number of days?
Could be a number of days. You know, you can make that determination that you've... that ideation has provided that cognitive opening for violence. Your grievance is so pathological that you see no other way. You project your inner feelings and disappointments and dissatisfaction onto this other group, the us versus them, and now you decided you've committed to your act. So it can, especially with a knife or a gun, it can happen very quickly. But this also provides, now the first two steps is where the community, we really, really need the community. But when this person starts to get to research and planning and preparation and breach, you start talking about this person comes into the open and gives opportunities for law enforcement now with the community's help to identify them, whether they're doing surveillance on a target, whether they're trying to acquire a weapon, whether somebody sees that and comes forward. So it's a yes and no.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that at least there are still openings that are potentially out there, even though, as you say, that those next stages can happen quickly. Bill?
And that's also the point at which the criminal law may be violated. If we can actually have somebody acquiring a gun, if they have a prior felony record, that acquisition by itself is a crime. If they lied on the form, as Dawn Wynn did when she acquired guns for William Spangler, just writing false information can be a crime and we can engage. And certainly if you're providing material support to a terrorist organization, whether it be money, whether it be advice, whether it be yourself, just that act can be the crime well before the deed was actually committed, i.e. somebody's dead because of this defendant.
All right, let me grab Jim in Rochester. First up, go ahead, Jim.
Good afternoon. Very interesting show. And to the law enforcement people there, the New York United States Attorney, your hands are full. Good luck. But my question goes back to the historical aspect of South Carolina. And you talked about it, touched on it slightly when you talked about the Ku Klux Klan. And we have to remember South Carolina was the first state to secede from the Union. In fact, Robert Kennedy Jr. wrote a book about that, Robert S. Small, the historical deeds that some black slaves went out and perpetuated an attack on Fort Sumter long before the Northern troops got there. But anyway, my basic question is, how do you, what's your take on the historical significance in the population, how South Carolina was populated, and the impact that that had on Southern culture and the refusal to acknowledge that America is a multicultural, multiracial country, probably the greatest thing that the nation has ever seen in terms of military might, in terms of mercantilism, in terms of tolerances for different faiths. And I just want to hear your take on that.
Jim, thanks for the call. Mark? I mean, that's a hard one to sort of piece together in terms of its actual place in someone's decision to carry out a shooting, but what do you think?
Well, actually, that's a very good question, and we're talking about symbolism, okay? So there's several different types of, there's actually two really types of violence that we have in America that researchers have come to. And Malloy is one of the great researchers in this field. Affective violence, which is very spontaneous and very emotionally filled and maybe even profit-driven. And then you have predatory or intended violence. And under that, which is very methodical, it's planned out, it's not spontaneous at all. And under intended violence, you have what we call targeted violence or opportunistic. So in this case, what we saw in South Carolina was absolutely targeted violence with the use of symbolism. Terrorist groups individuals who are trying to further their ideological goals or their social or political goals will choose a target or a particular group of victims based on symbolism. What's going to make the most impact? And I think that's what we saw in South Carolina. And unfortunately, that's what we saw, is the symbolism of the attack in that church, that most historic church, and the symbolism of occurring in that particular geographic was not by accident. The narrative that this individual accepted, and his this white supremacist narrative, and this idea in his mind that to resolve his grievance or the grievances of that group is that violence was an option, he chose the symbolism of the target, which happens all the time. It's called propaganda by the deed when we talk about it in a larger perspective for terrorist groups, how to further their objective.
Place, anniversary, connection to symbolic things like
exactly.
that. Jim, thanks for the phone call. Next call is Gary. Go ahead, Gary.
Hi, Gary. Thank you, Evan, for the show. As someone that was in law enforcement for 30 years, and during that time I spent over a decade doing training in critical incident management and command post operations, I'm delighted to hear the discussion, especially in regards to mental illness. You know, we've been hearing, and excuse me, Kevin, or excuse me, Evan, sorry, Evan, you know, we can't separate the discussion on firearms and the ease of access to firearms from this. I'm especially, again, pleased to hear this discussion by these individuals, because I hope it will help put an end to what we've been hearing about gun-free or free fire zones, that somehow places like Aurora, Virginia Tech, and Sandy Hook were chosen because they were, as Scope and the NRA says, gun-free zones, when in fact the research tells us that these are targeted. And it probably doesn't even matter whether there have been security there or not, that the shooters in these instances pick these targets for symbolic purposes. And I think it's also important to remember, and I would like to hear a comment, it is so important in these domestic terrorist cases that law enforcement have access to information about firearms, and yet New York, because of the SAFE Act, is probably the only state that I'm aware of, and maybe Connecticut, that has any kind of control over the secondary market. And that for most of America, domestic terrorists are free to buy assault weapons on the secondary market with no kind of tracking, no registration, no way for law enforcement to know who's obtaining weapons. So again, I appreciate the discussion, especially the points about you know, the targeting of these areas. So thank you very much, and I look forward to comments.
Thank you, Gary. Mark?
The key to the contemporary threat management or the pathway to violence is an emphasis on behavior, not on any type of profile. The profiles are, there is no stereotypical profile of an individual that is going to ascend this pathway to violence. So what we're looking at with all those different steps is behavioral indicators. And one of the most significant indicators of attack-related behaviors is obtaining a weapon. Okay, so that was one of the first things that we really, when I was working these type of cases, is do they have access to weapons? And if they do have access to weapons, how can we use that information to keep, because the threat level obviously becomes more intense when an individual actually has access to weapons. So it's a point well made that is a specific indicator. But once again, with the pathway, we look at behaviors, and that's just one of them, the access to weapons.
Bill?
And if you look at what the Tsarnaev brothers did in Boston without any firearms at all, managed to create a mass casualty episode using homemade easily procured substances that they put into a pressure cooker, I think the public can begin to appreciate the problem we have in law enforcement. So having a firearm is important to know, and certainly if you're a felon, that's a crime. But really the threat is much more substantial than that. And if the public engages and alerts law enforcement at the earliest possible stage, that can only help protect the vast majority of people, in fact, maybe the entire community.
Gary is also saying that he wants to push back against the narrative that some of these mass casualty incidents have been targeted because they're ostensible gun-free zones. Do we have any evidence one way or another on that?
Well, there is. I mean, if you look at, we'll take school shootings. I mean, there is in research and studies that do show that most of these incidents end when a gun arrives in the hands of law enforcement or an individual that does have a gun. And there are, this concept of soft targets is something that you really have to pay attention to. I mean, we've hardened our targets, our symbolic government institutions and our military and others since 9/11. But there you see the terrorist narrative of shifting to soft targets overseas, like malls and hotels, like in Mumbai, and you see this horrific attack that just occurred in Tunisia. So there is the terrorist, the individual that wants to do this type of predatory violence, will go to the least resistance. So there is some suggestion out there that evidence-based that these incidents end when law enforcement shows up, whether the person takes their own life or they're confronted. So that gives some credence to the fact that once a weapon is there, these incidences may not occur. I bet you're speculating and you're inferring, and it's just not enough out there to say that substantially one way or another.
Okay. Bill?
And I think where I would draw the public's attention now is a distinction between mass casualty perpetrators who may or may not be mentally disabled, mentally damaged, from terrorist perpetrators who may be acting on their own. In the latter case, the terrorist perpetrator, they are looking to create the most amount of chaos they can with the weapons that are available to them. In the case of the terrorist techniques, if they don't happen to have a gun, but they are motivated and committed to committing a deed, they're going to find something else. It might be an automobile. It might be the pressure cooker. It might be a Molotov cocktail. In the case of somebody who may be a workplace violence type of perpetrator, certainly a firearm is readily available in the United States. If that's what they happen to have, that's what they're going to use. I'm not sure that case, the non-terrorist mass perpetrator, though, would go to the additional steps of researching on the internet how to hurt the most amount of people and where to do it.
Okay. Jennifer writes to the program and wants to hear a little bit more about how prosecutors decide when it's okay to arrest somebody. Bill Hochul, again, the U.S. attorney for the Western District of New York, and the Mufid Elfki case, I thought was fascinating. Some really good journalism by Gary Craig and among many others who've written about the case in recent months. And so, you know, I've only got a few minutes, but just why don't you, if you can briefly encapsulate that as an example of how you're investigating, it appears to be a lone wolf, you're not going to go arrest someone the first day. I know you said it has to be couched in constitutional terms, and it should be. What do you say to Jennifer?
We'll make an arrest, especially if we have indications that the person is going to commit violence, just as soon as we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime has been committed. Now, in this kind of space, an attempt to commit a crime is sometimes enough. But again, it depends on what our evidence is. And if our evidence simply consists of statements made by the defendant, the purported defendant, we have to determine whether that's First Amendment protected speech or whether it's more akin to incitement or actual commission of violence.
And that's pretty subjective, right?
Well, there's case law on that, and unfortunately, the different Supreme Court decisions don't provide an extremely bright line for us in law enforcement. Once that line is crossed, though, if we can have corroboration of a crime, whether it be conspiracy to commit a crime or an attempt to commit a crime, that's when we'll engage. But the attempt law is written in such that a substantial step has to have been taken towards the commission of a crime. What is a substantial step? We crack open the law books. If there's at least one case that says this is enough, we'll engage. And here in Western New York, we have been very effective in using the federal laws to keep any particular terrorist events from actually being committed where there are casualties on the streets because of that act.
And we got about 90 seconds left here. Mark, what would you leave the audience with to make sure that they kind of keep in mind? We've been talking about this path to intended violence and what we all can do. What do you want to leave our listeners with?
Well, what I want to leave the listeners with is that this is a very complex phenomenon that we're talking about. And when we try to narrow it down in simplistic terms, like the cause is really the cause, we're not doing it justice, and we're actually, it's counterproductive because it feeds into the us versus them narrative. And if I could quote real quick Dr. Perlman, it's a great line in a recent article that she wrote: if we use a paradigm that splits the world into right and wrong, good and evil, us against them, and winning and losing in a zero-sum game, eventually we all lose.
Bill Hochul, I'll give you the last word as it comes from the same listener who emailed earlier, follows up to say, this has been a great conversation, but do you have any numbers that are a little more cheerful to indicate how successful law enforcement can be in stopping this kind of thing? Oh,
absolutely. My closing message is we are going to win. Terrorism, terrorist techniques have been around for thousands of years. They've almost never resulted in the complete overthrow of a society. Fast forward to the American experience. You know, there may be the periodic example. We have 9/11. We had the first World Trade Center attack. We've had other incidents from recent memory. But keep in mind, this is a vast country, and we're going to do it right with law enforcement, at working hand in hand with the community.
Well, I will say that I even intended to talk to these veterans in their various fields about what they thought of the recent manhunt with Matt and Sweat, and we didn't even get to that, so maybe we'll have to come back and talk at a different time. But there's always so much to talk about, and I greatly appreciate the time. William Hochul is a U.S. Attorney for the Western District of New York. Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mark Concordia with Roberts Wesleyan College and a veteran with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. Great perspective as always. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
All right, short break, and we're talking about the raise the age debate next.